Yes.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So hopefully we can start with the word of the Buddha forward. You got the forward on there? Yay! So just to show what we're doing, and I think Ajahn Brahmani is coming in, is he? Because when he was giving a talk here and I was in UK, I managed to send in a question from UK for him, and I'm just a bit concerned that he might do the same to me. It's a time for payback. Anyway, here we go. Just to give a brief... I'm not sure, where is he? I saw him coming out. I think he may be just going into the office. Doesn't look like it. Anyway, this is the reason why I keep translating this and just refining it, but it's got almost to the point now where it's refined enough, but I'm just going through it this year with you to make sure it... we find any errors. Uh-oh, yes, he is coming in. So, thank Lynn. So, Ajahn Brahmani, you're welcome to come in as long as you don't ask any questions. Because I thought it was payback from the time when you asked about the eggs.
You're okay.
Yeah, okay, no. The eggs questions, yes. Oh, what do I do? I'm just going to get the seat, first of all. So please come through, Lynn. Okay, very good. Good. So, the word of the Buddha, forward. In 1907, the pioneering German-born monk, Werner Bunyana Tiloka, published the English version of the word of the Buddha. It is described as an outline of the teachings of the Buddha in the words of the Pali Canon. It consists of a selection of authentic teachings from the suttas that expounds on the core Buddhist Dhamma of the Four Noble Truths, including the Noble Eightfold Path. You may notice straight away that I spelt Dhamma in the more common usage with an R, even though in Pali it's D-H-A-M-M-A. Most people these days in common usage use the D-H-A-R-M-A, because part of the point of this is to make this more accessible. For almost 20 years, I had been using the Word of the Buddha as a textbook to introduce my monastic students to the Buddhist suttas. Indeed, every Anagarika, that's a postulant, and Samanera, novice monk, must complete this course in basic Buddhist teaching before they are allowed to receive the higher ordination as a bhikkhu. I have taken such steps to establish quality control in the monks under my training, so, at the very least, they are made aware of what the Buddha really taught them from the most reliable source, the sutta. And unfortunately, in some monasteries, monks and nuns, they first come across the teachings of the Buddha after they have been many years as a monk or as a nun, a bhikkhuni. So I want to make sure from the very beginning they have some idea of what the Buddha actually taught. Unfortunately, there is a problem. Although the Dhamma is timeless, the usual presentation has become as if overgrown by impenetrable thickets of tradition. I have received countless well-intended criticisms that all the repetitions are discouraging. The similes are so archaic as to be obtuse, and some revered renderings of key Buddhist terms are rusted shut. The exegist is well past its use-by date. And a quote, "Rather turn on the electric light than complain about darkness." And you may already notice I use that very often, but usually in the archaic form, "Rather light a candle than complain about darkness." But you won't do that these days, would you? You'd rather turn on the electric light. Ancient Chinese saying, updated. Gives you an idea what I'm up to. This little book, then, is not another translation. It is a new type of translation. Not so much for detached scholars, but for those who immerse their whole lives in these teachings. I have followed Professor A.K. Warder's insightful advice that, quote, "It is the sentences which are the natural units of discourse and which are the minimum units having precise, fully articulated meaning. For purposes of study, we have to assign approximate meanings to words and list these in vocabularies. But these generalized meanings of words are extremely vague, whereas sentences have exact meanings. In translation, one may find close equivalent for sentences, which is often impossible to give close equivalent to words. Thus, in order to convey the meaning, I have chosen to translate sentence for sentence, a lot word for word. A word has no permanent essence outside of a sentence." And for those of you who have heard me translate these things before, I've used permanent essence in another meaning, which we'll find out later on. So there's almost like a hidden little, not a joke, but meaning for permanent essence there. So a word does not have permanent essence outside of a sentence. My authority to translate rests, this is for the introduction, but that's, I might say it here, on my reputation as a well-known Buddhist meditation teacher, trained to think in Cambridge University and then trained to be silent for 9 years under Ajahn Chah. Author of many books on meditation, teacher of Pali to many monks, and even taught Ajahn Bhamali Pali. Correct? And 45 years immersed in the life of a renunciant open to scrutiny. Open to scrutiny, I think, was really important. For example, for many years I have consistently protested against the traditional translation of concentration for the Pali word samadhi, instead preferring the word stillness. This is not a trivial point for debate amongst philologists, you know, scholars of words, for it cuts the very heart of the Buddhist path to freedom. Nor is my protest to serve an ego, quite the opposite. The practice of concentration and the willpower on which it depends actually reinforces the ego. On the contrary, stillness and the letting go stroke renunciation on which it depends brings the ego to cessation. So concentration needs willpower, willpower strengthens an ego, stillness needs letting go, which actually brings the ego to cessation. There's an important point there, which is one of the reasons why I want to put this forward here, so no longer use concentration as part of the path of meditation. Lastly, this is not the final version. Translations will always be work in progress. I only hope that this version will elucidate, inspire, and challenge. Students have remarked on listening to classes based on earlier drafts of this book, it's like listening to the teachings in the suttas for the first time, and their power can be frightening and at the same time compelling. Sometimes when you listen to the teachings of the Buddha, sometimes you do get scared. You understand what it really means and just what is necessary to do. As for improvements, I welcome better sentence-by-sentence translations, but only when they arise from someone immersed in these teachings. living as a renunciant for the cessation of all ego or any concept of a permanent essence within or beyond the five khandhas. And just a little quote there, a very famous quote by the Buddha, Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinavesanaya. There is nothing worth keeping, even your preferred translations. So, in other words, you can get it better? Great. So now we start with the beginning. We don't need to go through the index. I'm not going to read that out. And we go, the Buddha addressed the community thus. Are you on that page? Good. This is from Digha Nikaya 16. It is through not fully understanding and penetrating the Four Noble Truths that I, as well as you, have experienced the cycle of rebirth and death for a very long time. Because of not fully understanding the Noble Truth of suffering, we have experienced the cycle of rebirth and death by not fully understanding the Noble Truth of the cause of suffering, the Noble Truth of the cessation of suffering, and the Noble Truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, that we have for a very long time experienced the cycle of rebirth and death. So giving very clear the causes. So long as my penetration and insight into these Four Noble Truths as they really are was not thoroughly complete in their three phases and 12 aspects, and I did not claim to have realized perfect awakening in this world. When my penetration and insight into these Four Noble Truths as they really are was thoroughly complete in their three phases and 12 aspects, and did I claim to have realized perfect awakening in this world. You put that in there because often we chant that, you know, when we do the qualities of the Buddha. And here particular, just to make, to give you a taste of, to make these things easier to understand, we do something which I've never seen in translations of the Buddha's words. 1A, 1B, 1C, 2A, 2B, 2C, 3A, 3B, 3C. And they're listening in a way which makes it easier to understand. So 1A, the Noble Truth of suffering. And what do? Suffering is to be fully understood. Suffering has been fully understood. It does not say it has to be fully experienced. You don't have to experience every form of suffering there is to experience in this world to know it, but you can fully penetrate it. And the word is like really understanding what this suffering is. We explained afterwards, but it's a full understanding. And it's because people only understand a little bit of it that they have to be reborn again. And the Noble Truth of the cause of suffering, which is the wanting which causes rebirth. Very often we have the translation called craving. But craving is usually described as a very intense form of wanting. And the truth of the matter is that even moderate forms of wanting are still able to cause a lot of suffering, a lot of attachments, and to also to stop you freeing yourself from the cycle of rebirth. So even moderate types of craving was too hard, intense a type of wanting to really satisfy what this term dhanha really means. So to be wanting, the cause of suffering, is to be abandoned. And wanting, the cause of suffering, has been abandoned. The problem, what to do about it, and finally the problem has been fixed. And the 3A, 3B, 3C, the Noble Truth of the cessation of suffering, is extinguishing that wanting. Wanting, the cause of suffering, is to be abandoned. And wanting, the cause of suffering, has been abandoned. Abandoned, given up, renounced, let go, Those are the words here which in Pali was pahatabang, to be abandoned. And, oh sorry, that's here. The noble truth, the cessation of suffering, extinguishing that wanting. The end of wanting, the cessation of suffering, is to be realized. Not to be attained, because it's not a personal attainment. It's not something which you add to your collection of certificates you have on a wall, or medals which you keep for special occasions. It is a different word, extinguished, not attained or reached. The end of wanting, the cessation of suffering, is to be realized. The end of wanting has been realized. And 4a, 4b, 4c, the noble truth is the way leading to the cessation of suffering, the noble eightfold path. The noble eightfold path, the way to the cessation of suffering, is to be developed. The noble eightfold path, the way to the cessation of suffering, has been developed. You're developing, just like you're growing a garden, bringing things to fruition, stage by stage. And then, when it's developed, wanting has been extinguished, and suffering is ended. Thus, in regard to things unheard of before in my generation, there arose in me wisdom, truth, and liberating knowledge. When it says in his generation, it does not mean it's never been heard of before, but just when the Buddha was born in that particular time and place, such teachings had lapsed, forgotten, weren't available at all. I considered this Dharma that has been awakened to is profound, difficult to experience, and not easy to understand. Do you understand it? Do you? It looks like it's easy to understand. Peaceful and sublime. Those two words, even like peaceful, if you really understand it, it brings a deep peace to your life, to your mind. That's one way we can know if our understanding is really true or not. Why, how it changes us. Does it really bring peace? Unattainable by mere reasoning. It doesn't mean one has to give up reasoning when one contemplates these suttas. Reason is important, but it goes beyond that. Sometimes it confounds reason, like some of the things which you learnt in quantum physics. But nevertheless, it means your reasoning is based on false axioms. But if you go deeper, you find this is not unreasonable, it's not illogical. It just goes that much, much deeper. So you can't just reason it. You have to have more than reason. But it doesn't go against reason. Subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation is attached to the idea of a self, delights in what results from a self, and rejoices in their self. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely, the empty process of cause and effect, dependent cessation and origination. And this starts to refer to, instead of seeing something like all coming from me, a self, a permanent essence, or coming from some other beings controlling us, like a god or other divine source of power, this is coming from the third option of a process. This thing causing the next thing, which causes the next thing, which causes the next thing, which causes the next thing. Cause and effect, but nothing being caused, nothing being affected, an empty process of cause and effect. Not being, not being, but the in-between. And Furthermore, it is hard to embrace this truth, namely, the stilling and disappearance of the will. Not having your will overcome by somebody else's will, but the whole process of the will calming down and disappearing. Sabbasankara samatha. It is hard to even embrace the stilling and disappearing of the will, the relinquishing of everything that has been acquired, the destruction of wanting, everything fading away. It's okay, we can't control this. So we leave the baby to have a nice feed, as you feed on the Dhamma. So the empty process of cause and effect, dependent cessation, the relinquishing of everything has been acquired, the destruction of wanting, everything fading away, cessation, nibbana. And I refuse to have a translation for nibbana here, because it was a word which most people, at least, they have some idea of. Only some, but you get the full idea later on. There are beings with little dust in their eyes that are wasting through not hearing this Dhamma. There will be those who will understand this Dhamma, but not everybody. It's one of the reasons why in some places I don't really want to go to teach. For example, apparently in India, it's so dusty, everybody's got a lot of dust in their eyes. You're only supposed to go to places where there's little dust in their eyes. And the air in Perth is some of the cleanest in the world. So, I'll pause for comments. No? Uh-oh, I knew this might happen. Okay, Ajahn Brahmali, no. Okay, you can flip up and flip down. Very good, yeah. Okay, so Ajahn Brahmali.
I wanted to ask Ajahn about the idea of not translating Nibbana.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Because I think the vast majority of people have some kind of idea of Nibbana being a permanent essence or being kind of eternal happiness, something like that. Yeah. So I think that sometimes by not translating it, you're allowing people to read whatever they want into that idea.
Ah.
I think for me the point is that people in ancient India, they would have an understanding of this word would mean something. Yeah. And that you want to kind of give a current audience a similar kind of meaning to that word as they had in ancient India. Yeah.
Indeed, but if I translated that as extinction, recently that we had a group of people, fine-minded people, doing a very good job called Extinction Rebellion. But I support extinction, because extinction is one of my translations for Nibbana. So Nibbana being everything stopped. But I'm hoping that instead of putting that translation at the very beginning of this treatise, I will lead people to it surreptitiously, sneakily, by the very end, they will understand what this word, Nibbana, is talking about. But point taken, but I know you agree with me what Nibbana means, but anyway, this is coming soon. Anyone else? Yes?
I'll just follow up with the word
Nibbana. Yes.
Because this Nibbana we are talking about is on the line
on this Majjhima 26 that is written there. Furthermore, it is hard to embrace this truth. Now, this truth mimic all the phrases that is being written.
Yes.
Down. The staring of the. I can't even read my own handwriting.
The staring of the formations or something?
Yeah, the staring of. I mean.
Yes, but this is a far more accurate and meaningful translation.
For instance, the nimana of this phrase, all these phrases,
yes,
they're actually equivalent thing. We are talking about cessation nimana.
What
I'm trying to point out is that the gradual understanding, if you want to, it's not even gradual understanding.
Yeah.
It's inclusive of all these phrases, cessation, nimana. So if people want to argue, if people want to elaborate on the word nimana,
Nibbana, yes,
they must consider all those phrases in front of it.
Indeed.
And all those phrases in front of it, you can tell that it's a cessation going on.
A cessation, a disappearance, yeah, everything
and
fading
so
away.
So I think eventually, if you as a teacher want to tell us, it's called a people should understand,
yes,
nimana as extinguishment. I think,
yeah,
if they flip to this,
yes,
I just.
I understand what you mean, but if otherwise they may not realize that what I'm talking about.
Because of the way you translate this true.
Yes.
So, if you read the English sentence.
Yes.
You read it this way, you know that you have to consider everything before you just take the word nimana out.
Yes.
Okay, I finished with this. I want to talk on another point was that. Sorry, I just said. The truth. On the third noble truth.
The third noble truth.
The noble truth of cessation of suffering,
yes,
extinguishing.
That one thing.
That one thing. And the second noble truth, the one thing. If we are first timer, I don't know what's the first timer of Sutta class, whether they will ask this question, but I am an old timer.
Yes.
We have many kind of craving is being thought of.
Yes.
So that craving, and we are going to cease it completely. Am I reading it correct? We have to know that craving of number two.
Indeed.
Whatever the causing of the rebirth, because we can rebirth.
Indeed. But eventually we come down to the definition of what that craving is.
Correct.
And the Buddha tells in a very beautiful way things like being separated from what you want is suffering. And being associated with what you don't want is called suffering. So these are very simple definitions, but very powerful. So this is learning how to be at peace.
I understand
yeah,
what you. I mean, I can hear what he's saying, but what I'm trying to say is that if this is the teaching that of the four noble truths, and if it's been translated as the second noble truth,
wanting
of the cause of suffering, we really, it's very simple here, you know, wandering is to be abandoned, wandering has been abandoned. It's very, you know, it's like so easy, I want this, so don't want this, so you understand noble truth. It's not like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but again, this is the introduction. It sets the tone. But straight away, having translated things like sankhara as will, and saying the stilling of the will, total stilling of it, and it's an amazing thing to think that's even possible. And with the will, can you see the connection between the will and wanting? You want, and then the will is there to do the wanting's bidding. It's almost like a deep connection. What we want, we set the will out to achieve for us. And when we still all the will, and of course wanting disappears as well. When you don't want anything, where can the will exist? So anyway, I'd better get going on a bit further. And because we're going to go to some of this in the next part, The Noble Truth of Suffering. Has he got that on there? Yeah. And what is the noble truth of suffering? Rebirth is suffering. And straight away, I always love pausing at that point. Rebirth, any birth in any place, is fraught with difficulty and pain. It's not that you can be reborn in some plane of existence or some heavenly retirement home where you live happily ever after. This is fundamentally different from Walt Disney and the two, you and enlightenment, right off into the sunset, living happily ever after. It'd be nice if that was true, but it's fundamentally impossible. So, rebirth is suffering. Aging is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, unhappiness and distress are suffering. Experiencing what is unpleasant is suffering. Missing what is pleasing is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. In short, the five components of existence, the five khandhas, that fully describe your body and mind are suffering. So even not getting what you want is suffering. Are you getting what you want right now? We always have these wanting, and that's a separation. Here I am, this is where I want to be. And that distance between where you are and where you want to be is called dukkha, suffering. So where you want to be somewhere else, you're suffering. Now, what is aging? Oh, what is rebirth? Sometimes I mention this because some people with good will, good wishes, good intentions, but with not really being accurate and seeing the whole point of this. Sometimes they call rebirth in the moment. Just the next arisal in this next moment of these five components of existence. But this is how the Buddha taught. What is rebirth? In whatever type of beings, of whatever species of beings, there is rebirth. Coming to be, coming forth, the appearance of the khandhas, the acquisition of the senses, that is called rebirth. And what is aging? Again, very clear. What is aging? Whatever type of being, whatever species of being, there is aging, decrepitude, broken teeth, grey hair, wrinkled skin, shrinking with age. I'm really sort of hanging out for that shrinking of age with my tummy. So I know it's going to shrink with age because that's usually what happens. So I will eventually lose weight. And decay of the senses, that is called aging. What is called death, in whatever type of beings, whatever species of beings, there is a passing away, a demise, a disappearance, a death, a dying, decease, destruction of the khandhas, a discarding of the body, that is called death. Sometimes that these descriptions look like they should belong in a dictionary rather than a spiritual volume, but the reason I put them in here and the reason I suspect the Buddha said this is to make it quite clear what he meant. So the repetition here serves a purpose of being clear. What is sorrow? Whatever by any kind of misfortune anyone is affected by something of a painful nature. Sorrow, mourning, anguish, grief, unhappiness, that is called sorrow. What is lamentation? By any kind of misfortune anyone is affected by something of a painful nature and is crying out, weeping, making much noise for grief, wailing, that is called lamentation. And what is pain? Whatever painful feeling results from bodily contact, that is called pain. Whatever is unhappiness, whatever mental painful feeling arises from the mind, that is called unhappiness. So one is the physical, one is the emotional. What is distress? Whenever by any kind of misfortune, anguish arises from something of a painful or unpleasant nature, that is called distress. What is experiencing what is unpleasant? Well, whoever has unwanted, disliked, unpleasant sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, or mind objects, these are the six sense objects, or whoever meets those who wish you harm, cause you discomfort or insecurity, that is called experiencing what is unpleasant. What is missing, what is pleasing, whoever has pleasant sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, or mind objects, whoever encounters well-wishers, those who provide you with comfort or security, such as family or friends, and then is deprived of such interaction or connection, that is called missing what is pleasing. And what is not getting what one wants, subject to birth, this desire arises, oh that we were not subject to birth, that we might never be reborn, but this cannot be gained by desire. This is an example of not getting what one wants. In being subject to aging, to disease, to death, to sorrow, lamentation, pain, negativity and distress, they may want, oh that we were not subject to aging, to disease, to death, to sorrow, lamentation, pain, negativity and distress, that we might not come to these things, but this cannot be gained by wanting. That is another example of not getting what one wants. I've often noticed that many people come to a Buddhist center because they just try and make sure that they are wiser and kinder, so their life has not that much suffering. However, that is not the way to end such things. You just transform those things. Maybe a little less suffering, a little less problems, but you still have your problems. So the one way out is to not get reborn again. Make this your last life, rather than trying to touch up this life. Any comments so far? Yes.
Beautiful center here.
Yes.
So there must have been a want there to have that.
Yeah, there was, and there was a lot of suffering as a result of that.
Yes, so then if we are to release from that,
then we don't have suffering.
Correct, but in our lives, living our lives, we have like, at the moment I'm doing rebuilding in my property. Now I want that so that I can have a more of a, what I think would be a more peaceful life. Yeah. Now sometimes there is suffering in that. However, there has to be a degree of suffering here on earth or as being alive. So
yeah.
To get anything done.
Yes. But sometimes, do we ever get anything finished?
Do we need to?
No, it's great when we leave life unfinished. Are you going to finish all of your business, tie up all your loose ends before you pass away? It's impossible. So there comes a time. And why do we always want something more? Something extra? We start off with physical comfort, always building more things, more monasteries, more things at Dhammaloka for the Dhammaloka subcommittee. It's a lot of suffering for that. But eventually, when will there be an end of all this wanting? Sometimes we ask, was that really necessary? How big a house do you really need? You'll all end up in a wooden house. 6 foot long. maybe 2 foot 6 wide. So all of this striving was it really worth it? Or can we somehow imagine an end of striving? And I've got a lot out of that teaching of meditation, which every now and again, usually on a retreat, I teach people to imagine, visualize, they are the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, fully enlightened. Just that the first time the Buddha was enlightened. And to really build up that imagination, visualize it, I usually guide people through this, and you've finished everything which needed to be done, you're enlightened. The workman has finished the job, nothing more to be done, nothing more to be added. You can't improve on anything. And there you are, sitting under a tree. Nothing more to be achieved, nothing more to be lost or gained. You're finished. No more desires, no more wanting. Perfect, deep, 100% contentment. Just to feel the bliss of Nibbana, the absence of all wanting. And get people into that. We haven't got really the space or the time here to do that. But when people really start to feel what it must be like when there's nothing, absolutely nothing they have to do, nothing they need to get rid of, total finishing of all jobs to be done, no more wanting. When you know how it feels, and even just the taste, the sniff, then you understand what it means, the end of all wanting. Anyway, so go off a little bit. Yeah, please, yes.
I apologize for making your hard your life difficult here.
No, it's great. You're
no, I'm not going to make it too difficult. I'm just wondering about your translation of jara, because you translate jara as aging, and I'm not sure if that is if that is done intentionally or whether you just inherited from the previous translator.
Just inherited it,
but if you look at the definition, it probably is more likely to mean old age than aging. Old age is probably closer to the truth.
Be,
do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, because sometimes aging, but it does, what is aging? Broken teeth, grey hair, wrinkles, shrinking with age. I prefer the aging rather than old age, because very few people would really admit that they're old. But more people would admit they're aging. So, it is weird, but I am sometimes, when I had a youth group, I asked them, now what is young, what is old, what is very old? And when they're only about 11 or 12, they say, oh, well, about 22, you're getting on a bit. When you're 40, you're really old. And I was a 60 at that time. So sometimes aging, I think I prefer that than to old age, the wearing away of everything. So I'd prefer the old age, I prefer aging to old age simply because I think it's more relevant to people. Wearing out every day. Yes. Well, thank you for that. Yes. Yes.
Rebirth, death, and
yes.
What can you? Is it too early for me to ask whatever type of beings, whatever type of species of beings?
Yes.
Because we are doing. You are jhana teacher and. We come here, we accept the fact there is rebirth of us. So what is these beings and what is this type of species, types and species?
They have all the different, sometimes the Buddha described different species of beings, animals, birds, fish, and beings who obviously lower beings in the Preta realms, hell realms, and sometimes, what do you mean, in heaven realms? But there's even other beings as well in basically what they call the Jhana realms, the Arupa Loka. There's a huge, vast cosmos of places where you can be reborn. And it's not just the case that a human being gets reborn as another human being. Can animals, from animals to humans, humans to animals even, those things do happen. And sometimes people say, oh come on Ajahn Brahm, that's stretching the truth. But the argument I often bring out is the scientist who developed the whole categorization of species was a Professor Linnaeus. I probably pronounced it wrongly, but he had a scheme, what these days we might call like an algorithm, and applied all the different features of every being, living creature, which he knew of, to actually to organize them into different species. Like mammals, you know, who feed from the mother's womb, feed from mother's breast, you know, from the mammary glands. So all those different species I can link together. And he said he came up to three species, and he said, I'm thinking it was in his last papers, he regrets that in his classification called the species, he dropped his scientific integrity on three types of animals. And those three were gorillas, chimpanzees, basically, and human beings, Homo sapiens. Because according to his algorithm, they were one and the same species. But he realized if he said that we shared the categorization species between chimpanzees and gorillas, his work would not be accepted by the scientific community at the time. We all believed that human beings were totally separate from other types of beings. Because of that, he fudged his paper and put human beings in a separate category. He regretted that afterwards because he sacrificed his scientific integrity to get his paper published. But it was one thing which I say, human beings, chimpanzees, gorillas, we share so much in common. We are one and the same species. So why can't we get reborn one to the other? I can't help by being facetious every now and again. Where on earth do you think the bikies came from? Very good. Okay, so it's almost 4 o'clock. Are you happy for me to go on a bit longer? Okay. The five components of existence, the khandhas. And now again, the translation here, five components of existence rather than the five aggregates, because to me the aggregates didn't really convey the full meaning of this term as used in the context of the suttas. Sure, it's the case that khanda means any grouping of people, a grouping of things, any aggregation of stuff, any group of things. But in this particular word, as the Buddha used it, He always used it, the five khandhas, to actually the five components of existence. You, an animal, a bird, five things by which you get what we call a living being. And how in particular the five components of existence, suffering. First of all, what these five components of existence are. First of all, the body, that's usually a common translation. Instead of feeling, for Vedana, I have used experience. Vedana, the feelings, again, is a very ambiguous word. Sometimes it's part of the emotions, your feelings. And sometimes it is the physical sense of touch. But here, especially the way the Buddha described it, sometimes he said the three types of feelings, which are pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, or in between somewhere. But again, just looking more deeply into how this word was used, it really does, and as far as I'm concerned, it means your experience, this fundamental part of your existence called experience through any of the six senses. Yes, it's true, you can categorize experience as, pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. But in particular, it just means general experience in itself. And later on, that again has many implications. To see that experience itself is suffering. That's a powerful, scary thing. And of course, the proof of that is when experience starts to cease and finish in the deep meditations and the bliss of the freedom from experience. Perception I've used for the third khandha, sanya, which is very, very common. I don't think there's a better word for that in English. And again, perception is how we see reality, and later on we'll find the perception cannot be trusted. We see what we want to see. We're often in denial of what offends us. So perception, the Buddha gave the simile like a mirage. A mirage is real. There's a real phenomena there, but you're giving it a meaning it doesn't fully deserve. Or you're seeing only part of the picture. You're not seeing the full thing. And the sankhara, I've translated that or rendered that as will and other mental formations. It's almost like will and what comes is descended, if you like, from the will. But the core meaning of that is will. And the last one, even vijnana, you notice there is a slight difference between the usual translations, but it's a difference which has huge implications. Instead of calling vijnana consciousness, consciousnesses. Simply because when you call it consciousness, we think that this is the essential part of our being. But this is not the way the Buddha defined it. The Buddha defined there are six totally separate types of consciousness, each one according to the six different senses. Sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, smell consciousness, taste consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. And totally different, each one of those. And what that means is it's not some continuous underlying consciousness, always there, and what we usually identify as our core essence, me. So by calling it six consciousnesses, not a consciousness, you're actually coming much closer, in my view, to the Buddha's teachings confronting, but saying that this is what you take yourself to be. The body. It's amazing that these days people still identify the body as who they are. When you see so many bodies dead, aging, disappearing. Or experience, to be is to experience. Their perceptions they take as accurate and true, they believe in perceptions, I saw it myself. Did you really see it? Or what did you see? You saw something, but did you give it a meaning it didn't deserve? Will? Now this is where it really gets scary. When your will, who decided to come here this afternoon? Did you really decide to come here? Or was this process called will something which is independent of a permanent essence, a soul, a me, or whatever, a self? And after a while, it's scary to know, but the will is just a process, it's not you. Advertisers know that. Governments know that. They know how to control and get you to buy this, to vote that. But at least you know what this will is, and it's not you. You are not the one who chooses. And lastly, consciousness is six of them. So you can't hang your hat somewhere and say, that's who I really am. I am the underlying consciousness who's always aware. I am this being who's got my finger on the mouse, always ready to click this and click that. No, that's why it's scary. And they say the five components of existence are suffering. How on earth can one actually say that? So only when some of these or all of these cease and you're free, then you know how these are suffering. In the deep meditations, the jhanas, when some of these vanish, it's just like that simile of the tadpole and the frog. I haven't been able to find a better simile. When the tadpole becomes a frog, and she jumps outside of the water. Only then can the tadpole know what water was. The tadpole living in the water, all his life in the water, thinks water's great. Doesn't know what water is. But once it's out of the water, he realizes water is wet. Can't know that if it's always in the water. The same when some of these five components of existence vanish. Then you realize, when the Buddha said, these five components of existence are suffering, how right the Buddha was. Confronting, that's what these teachings should be. So, any questions or comments? Because that is a nice place to stop for today. Unless there is some from overseas. Are there questions overseas? Because sometimes there's always people listen from overseas. Just like I listen from overseas to Ajahn Vamali's talk. Was that a train between Paddington and Oxford? Yeah, it was naughty, yeah. Okay, yeah, go on it, okay, yeah.
Sorry, Ajahn, just one
more. Yes.
One more question, if I may. I was just listening to your translation of the Panchupadana Kanda.
Yes, yeah.
And you're saying the five components of existence. That seems on the surface to leave out Upadana. Is that...
Sorry?
It seems to leave out Upadana from the translation. You say five components of existence.
Yes.
Do you have any comment on that?
Yes, not the Upadana Kandas, because the Buddha said very clearly that the Upadana is not different from the five khandhas. It's part of the five khandhas. So the five khandhas in particular, you know, it would be part of will, and also just caused by perception as well. So people try to make a point of the difference between the five components of existence and the five components of existence either affected by or something with upadana, what they call the panchupadana khanda. But it was Visakha who, she was a bhikkhuni. Yeah. Telling her husband about the difference between the panchupadana khanda and the khandas. Sorry?
No, that was Visakha. That wasn't a bhikkhu. That was a bhikkhu.
Okay, bhikkhu, yeah. Okay. But was saying that the difference between the khandas.
Dhammadina.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Dhammadina. The difference between the five khandas and the five khandas with clinging is no difference at all, because the clinging is within the five khandas. And in other words, the panchupadana khanda equals panchakhanda. Five khandas, five components of existence, simply because it is the five components of existence which contain the fuel. I prefer the translation of upadana as fuel. It literally means, this is just a literal meaning. Sometimes literal meanings can be confusing and be off the point. But this particular case, ardana means taking, like adin ardana and upadana. It can mean just the same as the English word up, taking towards you. It means taking up those five khandhas as a fuel to produce the next five khandhas. In other words, this is describing these five components of existence as a process which feed off the previous five khandhas. There's a fuel going round and round and round. A self-fueling process. Please, by self I don't mean a permanent essence of a soul. I mean it feeds off the previous five khandhas. Keeping on going. The will especially creates the next five khandhas. Yes. Kanchana. No.
Do you mean by feeding off the previous five khandhas? Ajahn, do you mean the previous birth? The five
khandhas
in the previous birth?
I mean just what just happened earlier, even earlier, close enough to the last moment.
Okay, thank
you. The process. You might almost call it the momentum which keeps the ball rolling. Is the momentum different from the ball or the same as the ball? It's part of the ball when it keeps on rolling. Okay, there's some questions from overseas. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is meditation yet another form of escape from the here and now too? Thank you. Of course it is an escape. It's escape from suffering. So please escape. If you are in prison, wouldn't you want to escape, or do you want to spend the whole of this life and the next life and other lives in jail? It's an escape. Escape is good. If it's something which is worth escaping from. It's not from the here and now though. It's escaping almost from all those thoughts of past and future, the worry, all the wanting. The wanting isn't the here, wanting isn't in the here and now. Wanting is off in the future. Wang Victoria, it is hard for us not to be reborn. Don't say us. It's not we reborn, it's individuals. how do we retain the Dhamma knowledge in current life for the next one, so we continue the journey and not restart from zero again? It's not up to you. Of course, you will not retain knowledge as such, but you certainly will retain your inclinations, your karma, as it were. The Buddha's old simile, if a tree is leaning to the right, to the west, sorry, it's likely to fall to the west. It's your inclinations. If you spend your whole life letting go, being kind, being moral, you're not going to suddenly be a totally different being in your next life. Those inclinations continue on. It is just like the idea of the stream of consciousness, the mind consciousness, a stream which is never the same. Every standing on a bridge, the stream is always moving. But the stream doesn't suddenly just move into another direction. It's almost constrained by the banks, the course of the river. So your inclinations, it's very hard, even from life to life, for them to totally change. Even if you get enlightened, some of your characteristics from the past to the next life remain almost recognizable. What was it that, I think this was in some commentary, that Venerable Sariputta jumped over a puddle, and somebody said that, you shouldn't do that, you're a monk. And somebody said, no, because in a previous life he was a monkey and he liked jumping over puddles or something like that. Do you remember that was, I think I read it from a Tibetan book.
Yeah,
okay. Something like that. So they still have some characteristics there. So retain the Dhamma knowledge in current life for the next one. Your inclination to renounce, to be simple, to be peaceful, to let go, to be kind, all of those will, of course, continue on. If you're a stream winner, a sotapanna, of course, those things which you penetrated in a previous life will eventually bubble to the surface in the next lives. They have to. Lastly, from Scotland. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how can I be contented and not suffer for my youngest son has walked away? Your youngest son has walked away. That's the problem of this current life. As a mother, a mother, sometimes that can be a lot of pain for you. But I'm not sure of the details, how old or how young is that son. But eventually, sons and daughters will always walk away. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. And don't ever think it's your fault from Scotland, or it's your son's fault. Sometimes the nature of our world is to have these things happen to us. And it happens to everybody. Don't think that there's something wrong with you, or life has somehow had a glitch which should be fixed up. Our attachments, and our deepest attachments, are often tested. And the very beautiful story of Kisa Gotami, who became a bhikkhuni, fully enlightened, brilliant teacher. Kisa Gotami was the woman who lost her only son. Must have been very young when her only son had died. Didn't have a husband. Single mother, only thing she had in the world was her son. And she was grieving so much that when she went to the Buddha said, please heal my son, you've got the powers, I know you can do this. And the Buddha said, no. He said, oh please. So the Buddha did what we call a skillful means. He said, well, if you can find me 3 mustard seeds from separate houses in places where no one has ever died, then maybe I can fix up the problem. And of course it was a trick, because she went in full hope of being able to find this magic potion made of mustard seeds from houses where no one had ever died. thinking that that would cure her son. It didn't cure her son, but it cured her grief. Because every house she went to, there'd always been someone who died. Often when it's our loved one who dies, or our son who walks away, it's very personal. And to us, it's the biggest tragedy in the whole world. And sometimes that we can't sort of understand why other people are also not suffering so much. And we find out this happens to all people. She realized that her suffering was not unique. This was almost like the law of nature. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will sooner or later, be separated from us. And so, she didn't heal the son, but she healed her grief. She, I think, buried her son, cremated whatever, and then went off to become a bhikkhuni, became fully enlightened. A wonderful gift for the world. So this is actually how we can be realistic. People sometimes may think, okay, you're being pretty harsh and hard and uncompassionate. But this is the sutta class for those who want just more than just open the door of your heart, two bad bricks, when you get to the deeper part of the problem.
Five bad bricks?
Five khandhas, okay. And thereby letting go. Very good. Okay.
The flu that you're talking, from what you just say, is the implication is quite strong in the sense that, you know, put the law of nimana, it is really, it's a limited lifetime. It's whether it's six or more, it's not issue. Issue is that you really, by especially if you become a non-returner with the air far gone, the flu that you are, if you are non-returner now,
yes,
the implication is quite high. I'm not talking, of course, you want to be Arahant, but it's just, the flu just, what I'm saying, there's no more flu for the five.
The fuel, yes.
It's limited.
Indeed, yes.
And this is limited compared to the endless.
Indeed, yes.
And so, if we believe in you as a jhana teacher, it's very important this word of upadana. If people stay insisting on using their own other definition, it's up to them. But if we're going to use your definition and based on
fuel, that,
just,
yes.
And based on mindfulness and grace, we got to back and we got to very happy with all that we got teacher and then we just.
Indeed. So after a while, you don't do what you can, because remember the will. It's not what you do it. After a while, what happens, whether you like it or not, you're getting brainwashed. Transmission. These teachings, when you hear them, you can't ignore them. They get deep inside of you. I was brainwashed thoroughly by an Ajahn Chah. He was brainwashed by his teachers. And then get down the brainwashing done by the Buddha.
I definitely will finish this.
Oh yeah, you've been brainwashed
because
already.
As a teacher now, and we got limited lifestyle, I just felt that it's wasting so much of your time to explain that four jhana is important. To me, it's so important for so long. That it's so wasteful to your time to keep on telling people to sit for jhana. And if you want to embrace Buddhism at here, and if you want to have a teacher who keep explaining upadana is flu, why muck around, keep going round and round explaining all these things? To me, it's so sad.
Okay, that's my job, to muck around. That's very good. Okay, so that is the sutta class for today. And there will be another one in a couple of weeks' time, or whenever it is, whenever I have an opportunity to teach here again. And so hopefully that you have found it interesting, and hopefully sometimes teachings are not to tell you what you already know, but to take it further and deeper. So hopefully that little by little you learn a little bit more. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. Thank you. So now we can pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can all go our separate ways.